Parliament approves all but one of President Ibrahim Raisi's proposed cabinet ministers. Civil rights leaders in the U.S. state of New Jersey say the last month's police killing of a Black Army veteran highlights racial discrimination. The Pan American Health Organization says the unequal distribution of COVID-19 vaccines is the main weak point in efforts to fight the disease in the Americas. Thank you for joining us. Our top story this hour, Iran's parliament has approved all but one of the 19 proposed ministers of President Ibrahim Raisi. The announcement came on the last day of a five-day vote of confidence process held in Majlis, the parliament. Yusuf Jalali reports.
After 5 days of marathon debates in parliament over the credentials of President Raisi's cabinet choices, the final voting was held. All but one of the 19 proposed ministers won the parliament's confidence. Parliament gave no confidence to Hossein Barghouti, the proposed education minister, with 76 votes in favor, 193 against, and 18 abstentions. In his address to parliament, President Raisi said his cabinet will start its work as soon as the following day. He says he will not waste an hour to solve the country's problems.
After the vote of confidence is over, we will kickstart our activities with the new cabinet as of tomorrow. Our country is grappling with serious issues, and we must not waste even an hour to address them. Issues such as the fight against the coronavirus and the need to speed up nationwide vaccination will be on top of our agenda.
The ministers of defense, foreign affairs, and intelligence were among the nominees with the highest votes. Lawmakers say this signals that parliament shares the same approach with the government over foreign policy and national security.
This is meaningful. It shows that parliament will support the plans of the new ministers. And as the president says, the new cabinet will work throughout the day to solve the problems of the country.
Ibrahim Raisi handed his proposed cabinet lineup to parliament 2 weeks ago, a week after he took the oath of office as Iran's new president. Legislators then started reviewing the credentials of the proposed ministers behind closed doors for a week and in the open sessions for the past 5 days. With just one nominee dropping out of the list, it seems that the new government will not face serious friction with parliament in its job. Raisi now has 3 months to introduce a new name for education minister, and until then, a caretaker will be appointed to run the ministry. Yusuf Jalali from Iran's parliament.
Israel has threatened it may have to resort to launching military action against Iran to help the United States negotiate a new nuclear deal with Tehran. The regime's Minister of Military Affairs, Benny Gantz, has accused Iran of seeking to build a nuclear weapon. He said military action must be considered as a plan B to prevent Iran from accessing the materials for a nuke. Israel's chief of staff had also made a similar threat. The developments come as the Vienna talks aimed at reviving the 2015 Iran nuclear deal appear to have stalled. Iran has time and again rejected any renegotiation of the accord. Moreover, Iranian officials have on many occasions stressed that Tehran doesn't want a war, but will make a crushing response to any aggressors. Political commentator Frank Gemspach says the U.S. has to publicly acknowledge that Israel is the sole owner of nuclear weapons in the West Asia region.
The White House would have to recognize publicly that Israel also has nuclear weapons, and that if we're going to have an equitable settlement about this, everybody has to be involved. And I don't think anybody in the White House is even thinking about that at this stage of the game, or any stage in the last 20 years. And that is the biggest danger, where we think, because of the economic toll that we can exact on Iran, with the cooperation of the Europeans, that it's going to be enough to get what we want. And I personally, from the outside, don't see that. And I don't think it's going to work so well. And so the only other way around that, politically and organizationally in the Middle East and in Europe, is for the United States to be honest about this and say, well, Israel, you've got nuclear weapons. We're all in the same pool here. let us work out something where it's a universal settlement. Now, I don't think in the absence of that, that this is going to end well.
Palestinians in the Gaza Strip have held an anti-Israeli protest along the separation fence, calling for an end to the blockade imposed by the Zionist regime on the impoverished enclave. Zuba Shabit reports.
Thousands of Palestinians were injured in a protest east of the city of Khan Yunis in the Gaza Strip, where Israeli army fired live bullets and tear gas on protesters who came calling for an end to the blockade imposed by Israel. The mass protest organized by Islamic and national forces comes as a part of the popular resistance activities that demands giving Palestinians their rights and allow the reconstruction of the Gaza Strip after the latest escalation.
Palestinians came here to stress the importance of the popular resistance with all means. They also demanded their human rights and called for an end to the blockade imposed for 15 years now. Palestinians are only calling for their rights to live with dignity. Israeli regime should be aware that the resistance will support its people and it will force the Israeli regime to accept the Palestinians' demands.
Palestinian factions warned the Israeli regime in a press conference during the rally that they won't accept any delay in the reconstruction process and ending of the Kremlin siege imposed for 15 years that provoked Palestinians' anger, stressing that the Israeli policies won't break the Palestinian willingness.
The Israeli crimes against Palestinians have led them to come here to voice their anger. The Israeli regime must end the blockade and the Gaza Strip. Palestinians will keep to resist against the occupation regime.
Earlier, Palestinians held a similar protest where an Israeli soldier was critically injured and dozens of Palestinians were shot in clashes with the Israeli army. These protests held by Palestinians aimed to expose the Israeli crimes amid the silence of the international community.
We call for an end to this suffocating blockade that has deteriorated our lives. This protest aims to find a way out of our misery. This condition is unacceptable. International community must give Israel a punishment for its crimes here.
Tensions along the separation fence are still ongoing as Palestinian protesters here came to express their refusal of the Israeli blockade and demand allowing the reconstruction of Gaza following an 11-day escalation. Ruba Shabit, Gaza.
Civil rights leaders in the U.S. state of New Jersey say the police response to at least two incidents this year has been racially discriminatory. The activists pointed to last month's fatal shooting of armed Black Army veteran Gudia Dale in Newton. Dale was said to have been suffering from a post-traumatic stress disorder and was believed to have had an episode on the 4th of July. The civil rights leaders compared the case with the arrest of a white man who shot and injured a police officer and fled the scene in January. The activists said the state law enforcement exercised maximum restraint with regards to the white man and did not discharge their firearm. The U.S. has been the scene of protests against police brutality and racism over the past few years. Stephen L. Young is the president of the South Jersey National Action Network and joins us now. Stephen, welcome. I think the question is very clear here, and it's a very disturbing question to ask. If Dale, as the considering the examples that the civil rights leaders have cited, if Dale was white, would he be alive today?
If he was white, he definitely will be alive today. It's a shame living in America that the black man is still and the brown man is still shot down on the streets, most of the time unarmed, all because the police department has not been really trained to de-escalate. Here they are. We have police officers with a camera with mace, with a stick, with knowing how to de-escalate situations and not using it properly. And the first thing they pull up is a gun out, aiming at a person that was looking for help. Not a gun, but looking for help. So this is something that's been going on for years and years, and it must stop. This is an example of prejudices, special privileges, and systemic racism. Is the system going to continue to train police officers that work for the people? They're supposed to be public servants. They're public servants because they're using public money. They've been paid from public dollars. That gun belongs to the three people that they actually shoot down in the street. So are those bullets. And it's a shame it happens so much in the black community where they actually have to shoot down someone innocent most of the time. And then at the same time, they settle for different issues and don't be represented. Should happen to them. In other words, and they're supposed to be trained to de-escalate before they come and pull out a gun, and that's the first thing they use when it comes to black men.
Right.
But when it comes to a white man, they take them to McDonald's and make sure they're okay, and make sure they got the proper, they have the proper knowledge and the proper care to them. But when it comes to black men being shot in the street, we just got to see our loved ones shot down. And Dale was a military veteran that fought for this country, that fought for our freedom. The freedom on July the 4th, that he was shot down in the street after fighting for us in
right.
this country.
So
and it's a shame.
You're right.
That he was shot down through the systemic racism.
And you have to have a population that trusts the police officers who are there to serve the people. Mr. Young, thank you very much. I'm afraid we have run out of time. Very very good talking to you. Stephen L. Young, the president of the South Jersey National Action Network, joining us live out of South Jersey. Now, the Pan-American Health Organization says the unequal distribution of COVID-19 vaccines is the main weak point in efforts to fight the disease in the Americas. The organization's director, Dr. Carissa Etienne, said there are a handful of companies that produce the entire world's supply of COVID-19 vaccines, and they make decisions about the price and the destination. She noted that much of today's vaccine supply remains in the hands of wealthy nations. Etienne added that countries are also suffering because of production delays, leaving them waiting for doses purchased months ago. The PAHO director said only 23% of people in Latin America and the Caribbean are fully vaccinated, maintaining that hundreds of millions of others remain vulnerable. Last week, the Americas reported over 1.5 million new cases and nearly 20,000 deaths. Moving on, the United Kingdom has registered 149 more coronavirus-related deaths, raising its overall fatalities to more than 132,000. The country's daily cases also rose by over 35,000 to nearly 6.6 million. Britain has been reporting a steady increase in deaths among people who had been tested positive for COVID-19 since mid-July, when lockdown restrictions were lifted. Scientists have warned that infection rates will jump again when millions of students return to schools next week. The Italian government's plan to extend COVID green pass requirements to all key workers and state employees is causing a stir. Many in Italy are not willing to get vaccinated and are against the mandatory anti-COVID green pass. Max Giovanni is in Rome.
The Italian government is considering further expanding its Green Pass scheme, which is part of a plan that aims to have 80% of its citizens vaccinated against the pandemic by the end of September. Despite a significant recent slowdown in the vaccination rate, about 60% of the population has received both doses of COVID-19 vaccine in Italy so far. The government is now considering making it a requirement for employees to show proof of vaccination, testing or recovery at workplaces, including public offices and supermarkets.
La Sicilia, al primo, all'ultimo.
Mind you, the Sicily region, which has the lowest number of vaccinated people, could soon be classified as a high-risk red zone. The vast majority of those in intensive care units these days have not been vaccinated, and the Green Pass scheme serves the purpose of changing their mind.
Italy's Prime Minister Mario Draghi has repeatedly said that the use of the Green Pass scheme is the only alternative to a new lockdown. However, a conspicuous number of Italians are opposing the government's anti-COVID rules that they say infringe on their civil liberties.
Many in Italy are not willing to get vaccinated and are against the mandatory anti-COVID Green Pass. Earlier this month, protests were held in several Italian cities against the introduction of new measures requiring proof of vaccination.
L'essere umano è così, non siamo mai tutti.
That's how people are made. We cannot agree on everything, but the vaccine and the Green Pass is the way to go.
Basta queste scuse.
Enough with excuses. We are not kids. Maybe our authorities should be more severe with those who refuse to get vaccinated.
Since August 6, the Green Pass has been required in order to enter cultural and leisure venues across Italy. From September the 1st, the pass will also be a requirement for all teachers and other school staff. However, the National Association of Head Teachers warned on Wednesday that schools are not equipped to check all the students' vaccine passports. Max Civili, Rome.
That's up our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/parstodayen. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/parstodayenglish.
In the limelight.
As the U.S. government is left scrambling, watching its $2.2 trillion war effort turn out to have meant nothing, and seeking to pick up the pieces, it is now behaving very dangerously. The U.S. may not have a physical presence inside of Afghanistan in the future, but the fear is that its economic sanctions may end up being more deadly than its armed forces, says Robert, an English journalist, in an article titled "Freezing Afghanistan's Wealth, U.S. Scrambles to Hit Hard with Soft Power." Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. in keeping with the U.S. administration's pledge to withdraw from America's 20-year war in one of the poorest countries on Earth. The U.S. regime has yet to present any plan for future relations with Afghanistan, as it is reportedly scrambling to freeze Kabul's wealth for fears of it falling into the hands of the Taliban. In the midst of the sudden collapse of Afghanistan's government and the subsequent return to power of the Taliban recently, the U.S. troop presence at Afghanistan's Kabul airport has reportedly increased to 4,500 strong, with a further increase planned to 6,000 in coming days. Having abandoned its embassy in the Afghan capital and vowing to maintain a presence only at the country's airport, the U.S. regime has severely miscalculated the pace at which the country was destined to fall into the Taliban control. An unnamed U.S. official speaking to the Washington Post said any central bank assets the Afghan government have in the United States will not be made available to the Taliban. According to that same report, the U.S. administration has now frozen the assets of Afghanistan, the vast majority of which are not held inside of the nation's own borders. Some 80% of Afghanistan's annual budget is currently funded by the United States and other foreign governments, which may well end now that the Taliban have seized control of the country. In alignment with sanctions in place against the Taliban and Executive Order 13224, any dealings with the Taliban are prohibited. Executive Order 13224 was signed by then President George W. Bush in the wake of the September 11th attacks and was said to have been designed to restrict financing to U.S. designated terrorist organizations. This means that for one of the poorest countries on the planet, it may now be even more difficult to bring in international humanitarian aid at a time when the ongoing refugee crisis is expected to escalate. On May 6, 2019, the UN Human Rights Council, commenting on the implementation of sanctions against Iran, Venezuela, and Cuba, stated that the use of economic sanctions by the U.S. government for political purposes violates human rights and the norms of international behavior. It also warned that such actions threaten creation of man-made humanitarian catastrophes of unprecedented proportions. Over the past two decades, successive U.S. administrations have fueled their project in Afghanistan, working to build an Afghan military 300,000 strong, armed with some of the latest in U.S. military equipment. Between 2001 and 2019, the U.S. regime spent $133 billion on its nation-building efforts in Afghanistan. Taliban now seems to be taking a more pragmatic approach to politics, showing themselves to be more calculated than they previously were. Yet, skepticism is still high as to whether the group will carry through with pledges to maintain peace and to respect the rights of women. The U.S. regime is left scrambling, watching its $2.2 trillion war effort turn out to have meant nothing, and seeking to pick up the pieces. It is now behaving very dangerously. Having utilized the U.S. Air Force against the Taliban during the past month, now holding back the wealth of Afghanistan, the U.S. regime is taking a much more aggressive approach than that of its rivals. The U.S. regime may not have a physical presence inside of Afghanistan in the future, But the fear is that its economic sanctions may end up being more deadly than its armed forces.
Food for thought. Hello everyone, and let us contemplate on a wise aphorism from Imam Zainul Abidin, peace be upon him, the Holy Prophet's fourth infallible heir. Fear God and know that you will inevitably return to him, when everyone will see his good and bad deeds right before his or her very eyes. He or she will wish for the longest period of time to separate himself or herself from bad deeds.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
Times of sadness.
As-salamu alayk ya Aba Abdullah.
Wa innama kharajtu li talab al-islah fi ummati jaddi sallallahu alayhi wa alihi.
The words of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam in dialogue, a special program for the month of Muharram.
Sallallahu alayk ya Aba Abdullah.
Casting gloom on Karbala.
Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam, the grandson of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, the son of the Lady of Light, the esteemed Fatima, the son of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali. Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam, the beacon of light which guides towards equality and freedom. The one who addresses Allah on the day of Ashura saying, in so many difficulties and sorrows, in which plans and strategies fall short in solving, I have unburdened myself upon you and brought my grievances before you, O Allah. Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam, the master of martyrs, these are his words. Imam al-Husayn's words in response to Abdullah bin Umar.
قال الإمام الحسين عليه السلام يا أبا عبد الرحمن أما علمت أن من هوان الدنيا على الله أن رأس يحيى بن زكريا أهدي إلى بغي من بغايا بني إسرائيل أما تعلم أن بني إسرائيل كانوا يقتنون ما بين طلوع الفجر إلى طلوع الشمس 70 نبيا ثم يجلسون في أسواقهم يبيعون ويشترون كأن لم يصنعوا شيئا فلم يعجل الله عليهم بل أمهلهم وأخذهم بعد ذلك أخذ عزيز ذي انتقام اتق الله يا أبا عبد الرحمن ولا تدعن نصرتي.
O Aba Abd al-Rahman, have you not realized that a trait of the despicableness of the world before Allah is that the head of Yahya, son of Zakaria, was given as a gift to one of the adulteresses of the Israelites? Do you not know that the Israelites killed 70 prophets at the time between the dawn and sunrise? And then went to their markets and started buying and selling goods as if they hadn't committed anything. Allah never made haste against them. Rather, He gave them some respite and then got hold of them after that. The grip of a resolute, retributive one. Fear Allah, O Aba Abd al-Rahman, and never deny me your help.
As-salamu alayka ya asir al-qurbat. السلام عليك يا أسير الكربات ويا قتيل العبرات السلام
حسين شفاعة جده يوم الحساب. السلام على الخد الكريم.
And now let's listen to Dr. Muhammad Reza Fakhr al-Ruhani.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم وبنستعين صلى الله عليك يا أبو عبد الله. When Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam intended to leave Medina for Mecca, Abdullah ibn Umar, who was the son of Umar, the second caliph, intervened and intended to discourage Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam. Here it must be indicated that there were two or three groups of people who wanted to discourage Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam. Some of them were among the Hashimites, the close relatives of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam, because they had known that Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam would certainly be martyred at the end of that line. There was another line that wanted to discourage Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam and wanted to make a stop in the movement of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam, and they wanted Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam to recognize the tyrant Yazid. Abdullah ibn Umar came forward and intended to discourage Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam. Then Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam indicated it to Abdullah ibn Umar that, O Abu Abdurrahman. First of all, it must be indicated that Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam addressed Abdullah ibn Umar in a polite way, Ya Abu Abdurrahman, using his patronymic name, I mean kunya, and indicated it that Yahya ibn Zakariya, that is John the Baptist, was martyred, and it was an irony in the world of religions that John the Baptist, who was a prophet, a divine prophet, was martyred and was decapitated, and his head, his severed head, was given to a lady of pleasure in the Israelites, the Jews. And then Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam indicated that it wasn't the only practice of the Israelites to martyr John the Baptist. Rather, they killed 70 prophets, I mean, in the early morning, and never felt ashamed of the crime they had committed. And then Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam indicated it to Abdullah ibn Umar in that way. It indicates that the character and career of Abdullah ibn Umar can be determined from this answer of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam. And by doing so, by mentioning this, first of all, Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam intended to signify it, to stress it, that it wasn't only the case of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam to be martyred in the cause of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala by such people who claim to be the followers of the Islamic religion. Rather, it had been committed, it had been practiced, it had been done long before the history of Islam, in the history of Judaism. And then we find that Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam intended to teach Abdullah ibn Umar that the same fate was going to take place again in the world of Islam in another form. And then Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam addressed Abdullah ibn Umar that he shouldn't deny him his help. It indicates that Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam was resolute, was determined to move ahead. And up to now, so far, we noticed that Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam once mentioned the case of Moses of the Prophet. And again, Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam highlighted the case of John the Baptist, who was martyred. It indicates that Imam al-Husayn's movement was in the line of the divine prophets, and the martyrdom wasn't his only fate. Rather, martyrdom was the fate of John the Baptist and 70 other prophets among the Israelites. Sallallahu alayhi ya Aba Abdullah.
Above.
thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to this episode of the program Dialogue. We hope that you remain under the auspicious grace of Imam Hussein today and always.
Architectural firm in Singapore has come up with a unique idea to deal with the country's constant warm temperatures. A hotel on the island's busy business district has been covered with more than 20 species of plants to keep the place cooler. A layer of vegetation blankets the facade of the Red Tower, which is growing thicker with the passage of time. The plants reduce the ambient temperature by a combination of water evaporation and releasing cooler vapor. The architect says the tower is 10 to 20 degrees Celsius cooler than nearby buildings. The green facades also reduce harmful carbon emissions, which account for over 20% in the sprawling city. The world's highest expressway has opened to traffic in China's Tibet Autonomous Region. It's nearly 300 kilometers long and has an average elevation of 4,500 meters. It connects the cities of Nanchu and Lhasa, shortening the travel time from 6 to 3 hours. The road passes through many picturesque areas such as snowy mountains, grasslands, and wetlands. The expressway is also environmentally friendly. Special passages have also been devised for animals to get from one side of the freeway to the other.
Youngest panda at the U.S.'s Smith's Dorian Zoo, National Zoo that is, has turned one. Baby panda Xiao Qiji celebrates the milestone by eating a specially made fruitsicle cake with his mother, Mei Xiang, in Washington, D.C. Both pandas dug into their icy cake, an ideal treat in the hot and humid summers of the U.S. capital. Xiao has captured hearts and had many first-time experiences. Some of them include sliding and tumbling around in snow and recognizing his name, which translates to little miracle in English.
He was born during the pandemic, and given the age of his mother, we didn't think she'd have another cub. And the fact that we, not just that we had this miracle, but he has just been, he's given people moments of pure joy and pure happiness.
Xiao Qiji is a fourth surviving cub of Mei Xiang. Its older siblings now live in China under an agreement with the United States. Pandas have been reclassified from endangered to vulnerable thanks to reforestation to expand habitats in which the species can survive. There are an estimated 1,800 giant pandas in the wild.
The annual Butter sculpture has been unveiled at the New York State Fair to the delight of eager spectators. The artwork was sponsored for the 53rd year by the American Dairy Association. It was carved out of 400 kilograms of butter and took 10 days to build. The sculpture is dedicated to the children who will be going back to their normal lives after the coronavirus pandemic is over. Once the fair ends, all of the butter will be broken down and turned into renewable energy. Switzerland is constructing its biggest alpine solar plant in an effort to secure renewable energy throughout the year. The 2.2 megawatt plant is expected to be completed by the end of 2021. The Mutzi site will include nearly 5,000 solar modules and produce around 3.3 million kilowatt hours of electricity. It will have the option of delivering half of its production during the winter when temperatures drop to sub-zero levels in Switzerland. The developers say the project makes more environmental than fiscal sense. Currently, the country gets less than 4% of its electricity from solar power. An eatery in Japan is giving disabled people a new lease on life by including them in its workforce. Dawn Cafe uses robotic staff controlled remotely by people who are handicapped. Around 50 people with mental and physical disabilities help run the cafe. The pilots come from all over Japan as well as overseas. The venue was established with support from major companies and crowdfunding. It has become more than just a place to eat for its customers.
Customers here are not exactly coming to this location just to meet the Orihime robots. They come here because of the people behind Orihime, and they will come back to see them again.
For Kentaro, Dawn Cafe has a very personal touch. In his childhood, he was left unable to go to school due to a period of bad health. Now he aspires to come up with ways to further the inclusion of disabled people in society. Crowds of visitors and conservationists have been delighted by the birth of a rare orangutan in the Spanish town of Fuengirola. The new residents of the safari park made its first public appearance 2 weeks after its birth. The baby, yet to be named, is the only one to be born in a European zoo over the past 12 months. The park has launched a program to conserve Borneo orangutans that are considered as a critically endangered species. Their population has declined by more than 50% over the past century. Dozens of baby turtles have made their way to the sea after an unexpected overnight hatch in Italy. Italian volunteers were surprised by track marks of the hatchlings from an unknown nest in Sicily. Some of the eggs hatched in the morning. An environmental group following the turtles' movement said that 74 hatchlings made it to the sea while 5 didn't. The reptiles are an endangered species of oceanic turtle that also live in the Mediterranean Sea. Their population has declined in recent years due to hunting, loss of beach nesting sites, over-harvesting of their eggs and being caught in fishing gear.
A Slovenian enthusiast has discovered a new cave in the Alpine country, which is staggering visitors by its awe-inspiring looks. Ludwig Husu, a 63-year-old cave explorer, has come across a cavern that runs 60 meters deep in the ground. It's located in the country's karst region, an area of land made up of limestone. Some 14,000 caves are buried under the green forest of Slovenia, hiding away breathtaking stalactite and stalagmite formations. The limestone region is so pristine and uncharted that the European Space Agency has used the caves to train astronauts.
Yeah,
astronauts also know that the karst world is exceptional, special in a similar way to how a space environment can be. It is an unknown environment where you do not know what to expect at your next step. They have been here to train for precisely that, how to help yourself in a dark area where you're not sure what's going on and everything is new. That's very good training for space, and they have been very pleased to be able to prepare for something they might find in space.
Over 150 species, some looking like alien creatures, have been discovered inside the cave systems. They include an ancient aquatic salamander called the little dragon that can live up to 100 years. The animal was previously considered living proof that dragons had once existed. some cave systems in Slovenia stretch for tens of kilometers. They are so winding and deep that scientists say large parts of them remain undiscovered despite exploration efforts dating back hundreds of years.
The Light is a short bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
As the U.S. is experiencing its worst heat wave, Boston zookeepers are working extra hard to keep the animals cool to avoid overheating. Some get frozen treats, and some, like the yak, get a water hosing several times a day when the temperatures rise. The hardest part is cooling down animals belonging to cold climates, like the reindeer. Since reindeer don't like water, the hosing down is a big no. Instead, the poor animals sit in front of a desk fan all day to stay away from the heat. The birds have it a little easier as they spend most of their time in air-conditioned dens.
In Indonesia, a group of university lecturers have come up with an idea of building a robot to help people during the coronavirus pandemic. The robot is assembled from electric household items like pots and pans and an old television monitor. It was named Delta after the new coronavirus variant ripped through Indonesia. The robot was initially built to entertain residents of a village in the country's East Java province. But the head of the robot-making project says he decided to shift its function into assisting people dealing with a deadly virus.
With this new Delta variant and the surging number of COVID-19 cases, I decided to turn the robot used for public services into one that sprays disinfectant and delivers food and necessities of residents who are self-isolating. I'm shifting the function to serve only the members of the community who are in need.
The interesting thing about a robot is that it greets people when delivering things to isolated residents. The developers of the robot say it has been built in a joint project with local people and is by no means a high-tech device.
We don't know much about woolly mammoths that went extinct some 10,000 years ago, except there are scanned references in archaeology books. Now scientists have discovered that a giant mammals could walk incredibly long distance. Scientists from the University of Alaska have concluded that a male mammoth named Kik covered enough ground in its 28-year lifespan to encircle the Earth twice. To come up with the data, paleontologists analyzed one of Kik's well-preserved tusks. They say the animal lived with a herd through its infancy and youth and then went on to live alone. Scientists hope they will learn more about mammoths by analyzing further data from Kik's remains.
Prehistoric cave paintings found in Spain prove that Neanderthals were the first artists on Earth. A new study says red markings discovered in three caves near Malaga did not occur naturally. They were made by Neanderthals nearly 65,000 years ago. That's when modern humans did not inhabit the continent yet. The findings suggest that the pigments were applied at different times, sometimes more than 10,000 years apart. This shows that Neanderthals returned to the site over time to make symbolic markings.
I believe that this art made by the Neanderthals will be also found in other caves around the world. This time figurative art, which we have not paid attention to, may be precisely the oldest art in the world. So this place in Spain is one of the caves with the oldest art in the world.
Researchers say the pigments are yet another evidence that the intellectual capabilities of Neanderthals have been underestimated. Neanderthals went extinct about 40,000 years ago.
Egypt's forgotten art of Fatik is undergoing a revival thanks to a designer who has been working hard to bring the ancient cloth decorating technique to life. Working tirelessly in a small workshop in Old Cairo, Samer Hassanyan has enhanced the art of Fatik over the years. Samer is one of the few designers in Egypt to use the traditional method to design on fabrics. The art consists of patterns created by applying melted wax onto cloth before dipping it in dye or painting over it with a brush. The fabric is put into boiling water in order to melt the wax. The ancient Egyptians used the batik fabric mostly to wrap the coffins and mummies. However, the difficulty of mastering the art caused its disappearance.
Batik has disappeared in Egypt because no one shared their skill. As a teacher, I find that it is very important to provide as much training as I can, because people realize how difficult it is when they start learning the techniques.
Samer has now skillful artists in her workshop who design colorful fabric using the technique. Samer says her goal is to produce unique designs that are particularly identified as to Egyptian and represent the country's rich cultural heritage.
Artists in an Egyptian village work hard to keep alive the ancient tradition of making papyrus paper despite the tourist downturn amid the coronavirus pandemic. The village of Karamus in northeastern Cairo is the largest hub of papyrus production in the country. Many of the residents of the village are involved in farming, processing, and decorating papyrus planted in 25 farms near the village. The Pharaonic era tradition includes cutting strips from the plant, pressing them together, and drying them to form a sheet. The artists then decorate the papyrus to create beautiful products for tourists. However, the industry has been affected by the coronavirus pandemic, forcing the artists to use more creativity.
We are trying to think out of the box to keep this profession alive. We make products out of papyrus paper, like wallets, notebooks, drawing sketches, new products, so we can keep going.
The artists have also launched online stores to sell their new products. Papyrus producers say they have lost nearly 80% of their income in the last 2 years. However, they say they will never stop making papyrus and will make every effort to keep the ancient cultural tradition alive.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.